Yeah, hello and welcome to the Fox Football Podcast. Apologies for being on a day's delay, but we are here on a Tuesday and we've got a very special guest to make sure the delay is not something that will trouble you too much on the podcast today. Before we welcome him though, Daniel Garb here alongside Simon Hill.
And it's your fault for we're 24 hours late, Garby. You played in a charity golf day. How's the arms and legs today?
Well, I punished myself and the listeners because I played four rounds of golf in a single day.
Ugh.
5:30 a.m. we hit the first ball, 7 p.m. we finished.
How'd you go?
Okay, considering the brutal nature of it all.
But it was fun. We want numbers.
Well, I won the last competition of the day. Myself and Paul Gow beat right. Adam Peacock and Nick Davis. So as far as I'm concerned, the winner of the last game deserves all the accolades. So
absolutely.
I got one over Peacock in that regard.
The Monday podcast wins.
Exactly. It was a great day. Raised money for
great
charity.
Stuff.
So
well done, mate.
I think someone asked a question about it later on in Twitter questions. We can go into a bit more detail. But it was a lot of fun, that was for sure. But it's all about football for the next hour or so. And we're very happy to have this man with us in the podcast room. He's made the trek down from the Central Coast. He'll make the hour trek back after the podcast. So well done on the Mariners who have brought him in today. And to Tommy Orr, who is proudly wearing his Central Coast Mariners polo shirt, for coming in and joining us on the podcast. Hello, Tommy.
Cheers, guys. Thanks for having me
on. Good to see you, Tommy. How's things up in lovely Terrigal? That's where you're living. I think every single Mariners player lives in Terrigal, don't they?
I think they have for the last 10 years. So, it's fantastic. I'm enjoying my time on the coast a lot. And, been a pretty good start of the season.
Because you're a Gold Coast boy, or Southport, I think it is that right?
Yeah.
So this is pretty similar to where you grew up?
Very.
Terrible,
very,
I mean?
Very.
Not Sydney, where we are at the moment.
Yeah, I like the kind of laid-back atmosphere, I guess. So, the coast is a pretty good fit for me.
Yeah.
And you've had a reasonably solid start to the season. The Mariners certainly improved from last campaign, which wasn't hard for the club, of course. But to be in that position now where the Mariners seem competitive in every game, how good's that been for the people in the squad?
Yeah, it's been great. And obviously we had a pretty big turnover this season. I think 16 or something new players. And for us, it's just building blocks. And we've probably been a little bit inconsistent the first 6 or 7 rounds. But there's been a lot of good signs moving forward, I guess. So it's just a good platform for us to build from.
And how's your body holding up? Because you had that horrendous injury last season, which it still makes me wince when I watch it. Like a freak injury, really, just the way you landed.
Yeah.
That must have been hugely frustrating. Always is for any footballer when you have a long-term injury to deal with. How do you deal with that?
Yeah, it was obviously, to be honest, it was probably on the back of a few other niggles which I had. So the last 2 or 3 years of my career, I've been probably plagued with injuries, which has been unfortunate, and capped off with that nasty one that you said. And it can be very frustrating, and that's one of the big challenges being a footballer is facing that kind of adversity, I guess. But I think I'm pretty fortunate in the sense that I'm surrounded by some really good people, pretty level-headed family, and all these kinds of things. And you just kind of get on with it and work hard and try and dig yourself out of the hole. And the Mariners medical staff did a really good job with me, and I'm feeling really good now. So
great to see you back playing some really good football, and we'll talk about your positional change and other things, the leadership role you've got at the Mariners as well, maybe a bit later on. You're a pseudo-captain at times when Matty Simon's not starting. So that's
it is the great question around Tommy Orr, isn't it? Does he play as a 10 or does he play wide?
Well, let's get into it now, because Tommy knows I'm incredibly biased on this, and it's been one of the agendas I've pushed in Australian football, watching you at Utrecht playing as a 10. I've always thought that is your best position. You've played a bit there this season. I mean, yep. Is that where you prefer to play? Is that your best role now, do you think?
I think that when I first started my career, I was an out-and-out winger, kind of, boots on the sidelines, trying to whip crosses into the box. And I think that the first few years in Holland, they kind of moulded me into more of a midfielder. And I must admit now, I think my mentality and the way I like to play is probably more fitting for a midfielder. I think
good.
The coach probably gets the shits with me a fair bit when I'm, probably don't have the attacking mindset playing out wide that I sometimes should. Maybe I'm a bit more conservative, thinking more like a midfielder, like I said. So, but to be honest, I like playing both positions. So depending on the context for the whole team.
I'm going to play devil's advocate here.
Yeah,
I like you on the wing because, and I've seen you play there a few times this season as well. I know you've switched between the two. The way that you can whip a ball in, and you don't necessarily, with respect, Tommy, I don't think you have blinding pace,
no.
But you can create an angle. You can create that meter to, and your delivery with the left foot, as we've seen for many years, is beautiful. I think you're much better out in that position, but that's just me.
I think so far this season, I've kind of been afforded a bit of luxury to kind of move in and out from a central or a wide position as I see fit, really. So
You've been given a license.
Yeah, so I'll keep that in mind more and maybe try and whip a few more crosses in.
Stay in the number 10 roll, Tommy, the free roll. That's where you can navigate your way into dangerous areas and shoot from distance. We're going to talk about all the action from the A-League over the weekend. The Ballon d'Or was announced this morning. We'll go through that as well. The Premier League, so much going on over there and some Twitter questions too, as well as Ange Postecoglou's achievement. And we'll go through what caught your eye over the weekend. But let's start with a very pertinent point in Australian football, and it's wonderful that Tommy's in for the podcast this week. It's certainly fitting because we lost Pim Verbeek late last week, which has been devastating for everyone, and he gave you your debut, which obviously is something that means a lot to you. Incredibly sad news. I love the way that it was marked over the weekend in the A-League with the black armbands and the round of applause before every game. But Simon, you start on Pim, because I think you were closer to him than anyone in Australian football, and you managed to draw a really close connection to him from his time with Australia.
Yeah, well, I wouldn't say closer than anyone in Australia, but certainly, you know, from a media point of view, I was very close to him. And it was a friendship that continued long after he left, you know, the coaching role with the Socceroos. He stayed in touch with a whole heap of people. I know that for a fact. I was lucky enough to be one of them. And I just want to say, and I said this in a piece that I wrote for the Fox Sports website, that Pim was genuinely one of the kindest, nicest men I've ever met. In fact, the kindest, nicest man I've ever met in football. I've never had a friendship in the game quite like it, and I know a lot of other people have said the same thing. He was genuinely interested in us as people. He loved Australia. His daughter continues to live here. He visited many times, even after he left the national team job. And I was fortunate enough to see him on many, many occasions. The last time, sadly, was at the Asian Cup in January. We spent New Year's Eve together in Abu Dhabi, where he was coaching Oman, of course. I knew Pim was sick. I knew that, I got a text from him a week or so back saying that the cancer had sadly beaten him, and they'd stopped all treatment. Obviously, the speed of his passing was, you know, what we didn't know, and that's been devastating for a lot of us, including me. But I think there's no positive in somebody passing before their time, but the one thing that I take some comfort in is that Pim's true personality, which wasn't always apparent in Australia when he was national team coach. He got a lot of stick here, and people accused him of all sorts of things, being arrogant and part of this, you know, silly Dutch mafia that allegedly ran the game. Pim was a great human being, and that's been revealed in spades since his passing. So I'm glad that people have sort of got to know, albeit posthumously, his real persona, because trust me, he was an absolute champion, a real good bloke, and I'm devastated at his passing. I'm sure, Tommy, you're the same.
Yeah, well said, Simon. We're going to get into your career in detail later on, Tommy, but with the Socceroos, it all started under Pim. So your thoughts and your insight into him as that person that Simon's just described?
Yeah, I mean, I read your piece on Fox Sports.
Thank you.
Yeah, at the start of the week, and I think that pretty much nailed it on the head. Everyone who ever was a part of any of his teams or got to know him well had the same opinion of the man. Fantastic man, very genuine. I think that was the right word that you said, that I thought was pretty much encompassed him, and he'd be greatly missed. And for me personally, he obviously gave me probably kicked off my career, giving me the my first Socceroos cap, and also being instrumental in getting me over to Holland. So for me, I can't be thankful enough for him.
Can you remember anything he might have said to you when you were making your national team debut or you came into the squad that stands out? Any sort of interactions that really resonate?
I think that it wasn't a particular conversation or anything. It was just the manner of him. Obviously, me being 18, coming into a Socceroos setup full of stars, for me was obviously quite daunting, and just his manner was so comforting for me, and he just made me feel like I was a part of the furniture. And that's obviously, as a young player, kind of you can't really buy that, I guess. It's just the nature of him. So that was something that I found, yeah, that was very comforting.
Well said. Yeah, I mean, I didn't interact with him as much as you did, but whenever I did, I always found him so personable, so affable. I remember walking around Etihad Stadium with him once to go to an interview on radio, and just talking to him about Dutch football and Marco van Basten, and him being so engaged in the conversation with me. I was just a little kid, and I was just loving it, basically, and thinking just what a good man. And just before, you know, I know you got something to point out here, but I wanted to point out his record as a Socceroos coach, because he's spoken about the personal side, which is so important. But he got us through the second phase of qualifying without losing a game. We know how difficult that is now. And yes, that Germany game didn't go to plan, but we drew against Ghana with 10 men. And our last World Cup win came under Pim. We haven't won a game in the last two World Cups.
And the best win too.
Against Serbia.
No disrespect to Japan, but, you know, that was a tough game.
Yeah. He led us to that triumph. Yeah. So he could coach, really good coach.
And I think it's worth adding too, that Germany team that we lost 4-0 to beat Argentina 4-0 in the same World Cup. So
yeah.
It's put in for perspective.
And they thrashed England as well, 4-1, I know, because I was there. Just to bring it right up to date, sort of a little postscript, I know that we're going to talk about Ange Postecoglou. I got a message from Ange, and I'm sure he won't mind me sort of saying a bit of it. He said that Pim reached out to him towards the end of his Socceroos reign and was very supportive, which meant a lot to him. A very kind man, also very well respected here in Japan, said Ange, and there was some tributes to him over the weekend. So, you know, that's nice to hear that there was that continuity and respect between Socceroos coaches of different generations as well. That was typical of Pim.
Yeah, great to hear. Well, let's transition into Ange now, because what an amazing story this is. And Tommy, again, fitting. I mean, you played a lot of football under Ange Postecoglou. I dare say you're not surprised at all that he's had the success in Japan?
No, not at all. I think everybody, like, similar to Pim, who's worked under Ange, only has glowing reports of him. He's a very demanding coach, but he just knows, he has a way of getting the best out of everyone. And he knows that not two people are the same, and he just knows what buttons to push for each individual. And I think that's probably the best thing about him.
Is it true that if you're not in the starting 11, you're almost invisible to Ange or not? Because that's sort of the rumour. We don't know for sure because we're not players, but
yeah,
you are.
Yeah, no, I think that if I compare him, for example, with a lot of the coaches that I had in Holland or in Europe, that's very much the case, what you've just said. And I think Australian coaches by nature don't really have it in them to be like that. For me personally, he's always been kind of the coach that's put an arm around my shoulder and being very positive and all these types of things and giving me a lot of confidence. And, I've been through spells with him where I was playing, obviously, in the World Cup, started all the games, and then at the Asian Cup I wasn't in the squad. So I've experienced kind of both ends of the spectrum, and his relationship with me never changed. So for me, I'm not surprised at all, and it's just fantastic to see an Australian coach doing so well.
You'd have to be under a rock to not know the Postecoglou story, shielding you away from Australian football, but he's going to win the J-League. It would take a ridiculous set of events for him not to do so. They'd have to lose by a 4-goal deficit at home to FC Tokyo on the weekend, which, let's be honest, it's not going to happen considering the way his team's playing. So he's going to be the first Australian to win a major league like this. I know others have won other leagues, but let's be honest, the J-League's on a different level to some of those. It's an extraordinary achievement. I had a mate who likes football but doesn't follow it that closely message me over the weekend and say, why is it such a big achievement? Explain it to me. I don't really understand. And there's the obvious one of an Australian having never done it before, the fact that he had to learn, not learn the language, but communicate to the players through a translator, learn the culture. In his second season to win it, considering all of that, ridiculous. But for me, the aspect that stands out that has made this such a big story is because of what it may provide. And that is the platform for him to hopefully go to Europe, and therefore other Australian coaches to break down that final frontier in Australian football, which is an Australian manager making it overseas. The players have done it. They did it in the late 80s, early 90s with regularity. We've never had a coach do it and break down that barrier. Ange, it feels like it can be the one now.
And I saw that you suggested that maybe a long shot, of course, that Arsenal are looking for. Well, you know, and we laugh at this, but many years ago, and you made this parallel, Arsenal went to Nagoya Grampus and said, your coach, this guy Arsene Wenger, who nobody had heard of before, really, quite frankly, you know, we'll take a gamble on him. And that was a long time ago. But, you know, look what happened since then. So I have no doubt that Ange can coach at the highest level in Europe. I hope he gets that opportunity. For me, what this does is it cements his place. And I've just to plug my own little article here on the Fox Sports website. I've done a top 10 of Australian coaches of all time, and for me, Ange is up there. And then there's Daylight. No disrespect to all the others. Yeah. His record is phenomenal.
Who's 2 and 3?
Two, I put Rally Rasic because even though he only won one national title with RPL Leichhardt in 1987, obviously he led a team of part-timers to the World Cup in 1974, which was a heck of an achievement. Yeah. Third, I put Les Scheinpflug because obviously he had a lot of success. Still the only Australian coach to take a national team to a World Cup final, which he did with the under-17s in 1999, and plenty more besides.
Just want to ask you on Ange. No one in Australian football has any doubt that if he goes to Europe, he could succeed. But it's about getting that chance, firstly, at a club or a league that he would be happy going to, one that's of a standard that is suitable for him. But also it's winning over players who would think, let's be honest, even though we're in 2019, oh, an Aussie, what can he teach me about football? Which is ridiculous, but that is the way it would probably translate in the minds of
a big Premier League club. I don't know whether it's because he's Aussie per se. I think it's just more the fact that, you know, teams in the Premier League, Germany, Holland, they tend to look within Europe. Now, Africa, is a place where a lot of these coaches then go and learn their craft and come back to Europe. Asia's a little bit different. I think, there's not many. How many Korean coaches are there? How many Japanese coaches are there in the top leagues of Europe? It's not an Aussie thing. It's an Asian thing.
I think it would be.
I think.
I think it'd be a struggle for him if he went to Everton or West Ham. Can you explain what it would be like in a dressing room to try and win over the players in that situation?
To be honest, I don't think it would really be at the forefront of your mind. I think that obviously first impressions, when a coach walks in, if you have no previous experience or knowledge of the coach, that's kind of the thing that would make your opinion of him. And for sure, Ange, that would be probably his biggest challenge if he was to go and coach in Europe, is to obviously have all these different cultural kind of egos and all these kind of things that he probably doesn't have to deal with in the teams that he's coached so far.
Yeah.
But I think that he's more than capable of handling that. And I think that as well, when the team he's at now, they played Manchester City in the preseason, and Pep Guardiola was full of praise for the way they played football. And that just kind of shows that level that he's coaching at. So,
I think also it's about, if you look at a lot of the top coaches, obviously Mourinho is probably an exception. There's maybe one or two others, but they all have glittering playing CVs, which, with respect, Ange, played his career in Australia. So that's not quite the same mentality for a European. You look at Harry Kewell, got an opportunity, to coach, albeit he started off at the lower level. He might get another opportunity. Tony Popovich was assistant coach at Crystal Palace because they'd had that playing career at that top level in Europe, whereas Ange didn't specifically have that. So that's why he's having to go the roundabout route to prove himself in Asia. But, I'm with you. I hope he gets an opportunity. I think he'll kill it if he does.
Oh, I've no doubt. So hopefully this lays the platform for it. Brisbane is where it all started for Ange Mark II after South Melbourne. Unfortunately, they got, from your point of view, Tommy, the better of you on the weekend. It feels like you're up and down on the Central Coast at the moment. You have a good run and then it drops back a little bit. What went wrong on the weekend?
Yeah, it was obviously a disappointing game. I thought that we knew that they were going to start fast. Obviously, having on the back of a few disappointing results from their end, it was almost like a cup final for them. And we knew that the first 10-15 minutes was going to be 100 miles an hour. We'd kind of have to match them. And then when the game settled down, we'd try and sort of impose ourselves on them. But we never really got going, got into the game, and they were fully deserving of the win. And for us, it's just a matter of picking ourselves up and trying to turn around next week. And I think that that's kind of been reflective of our start to the season, is up and down, like you said. Mm. And I think that's a large part due to the large player turnover that we've had, and having a lot of younger players as well, who probably haven't experienced the A-League and the demands physically and mentally and these types of things week in, week out. And I think it's going to be a process for us to be a bit more consistent. But I think it's been a solid start.
It's better than being down all the time, which, let's be honest, you were last season. Alan Stadger, give us some insight into him, because he's obviously been a massive story in Australian football for 12 months. And it's great to see, after what happened to him, the way in which he's transitioned into, you know, a stable role at a men's club, which is something he wanted to do as well down the line. What makes Stadger a good coach?
Yeah, he's very demanding. I mean, you go to training every day knowing that he's on your case and that you have to be ready and to perform at the highest level at training. And to be honest, I think we probably train as hard as I've ever trained in my career in any club. And I think that's his kind of whole mantra, is to play the way you train. And if you train with that intensity, you don't need to find a new gear on match day kind of thing. It's just... you can just do what you've been doing all week.
You actually made some parallels. I seem to think in an article that a journalist wrote a few weeks ago, where you said that Stadge was similar in many ways to Ange Postecoglou in the way that he coached. Is that right?
I think what I'm talking about now is pretty much the main similarity. Yeah. Is the demand for the intensity of the training. And for example, in Holland, there was a lot of coaches where they would maybe conserve your energy for the weekend and it wouldn't be as intense, the training. It'd be more tactical and going through the motions. Whereas with these two coaches, more so than any other coaches I've had, when you're at training, it's match intensity. Mm. And if it's not, then it's not acceptable. And I think that's a good way to, especially with a lot of young boys in the team, to prepare them for the weekend. So.
Great. Yeah. A big win for Brisbane, as you said, a cup final for them. Robbie Fowler needed that. I know you're upset that it came against your team, but for the health of the Roar, they really needed that victory on the weekend. So that was a good one for Robbie Fowler. The Victory needed a win as well. Wow. And they crucially responded in Lee Broxham's 300th game. Tommy, you've played for a lot of clubs. I mean, can you believe that someone, considering most A-League players play for 300 clubs before they retire, has played 300 games with the one team in the environment that is the A-League, especially a club as demanding as the Victory?
Well, that's right. I mean, the player turnover in the A-League is obviously, everyone knows about it, but to play 300 games for the Victory and in a league where there's, what, only 20, 25 games a season, especially at the start of the early doors in the A-League. So it's quite remarkable. And he's always been one of those players that you don't like playing against. He's a fantastic guy, but on the field, he's a fierce competitor. So, it's fantastic, and I couldn't be happier for him.
Andy Harper made a good point about him a couple of weeks ago in commentary, and we're talking about this, you know, that milestone coming up. And he said rightly that, you know, before every season, you look at the Victory squad, and they normally pack it full of, you know, big marquees and top internationals, and you think, yeah, Lee Broxham's going to be sat on the bench. And every season, he plays almost every game. Because he can play every single position.
Yeah.
And obviously you get injuries and, you know, players dropping off in form or what have you. And Lee just seems to, left back, right back, centre back, midfield, up front, whatever. Yep, no problem. And he just slots into any one of those roles seamlessly, doesn't he? Which is an incredible talent, really. So that's why he's lasted so long. Congrats to him.
Fantastic. Brilliant. It felt like the first 20 minutes in the game with the Glory, the Victory were a bit disjointed. And I remember thinking, oh, this is not going well for them. The Glory were on top. And they were struggling. And then it seems as if the individual quality of their players got them back into the game. Robbie Cruz had a really big game. He scored the goal, of course. Andrew Naboot got into it a bit more. And it feels as if those individuals got the team back on track, which sometimes you need in games, the big players, just to pull everyone in the right direction. You know Robbie Cruz very well, don't you?
You must
be pleased for him after his injuries.
Very. And I think, touching on Victory, I think they've been pretty unfortunate with the injuries they've had so far this season. And it's kind of hard to hit the ground running when, almost all of your main players are on the sidelines. And but on Robbie, it's fantastic to see him back in the A-League. And it's obviously, from a personal point of view, I'm quite a good friend of his. And it's been disappointing, I think, over the last few years to see a lot of the criticism that he's copped representing the Socceroos or playing for his club unfairly, in my opinion. And I think that, it's great to see him back in the A-League, and I think that he'll change a lot of people's opinions.
You were the three amigos, weren't you? There was you, Robbie Cruz, and Michael Zullo all sort of came through at the same time. There were others as well, like Mitch Nichols and Adam Sirota. Like a real fertile period in Queensland, where this whole group of hugely exciting young players all came through together. Is there a bit of a bond still between you all, or, you know, now you've gone your separate ways and played in different parts of the world, do you struggle to stay in touch?
No, we all definitely stay in touch. obviously with Adam and Michael, I moved overseas with them. So particularly with those two, I have a very close relationship. But with Robbie as well, obviously started my career at Brisbane and when he was playing for Brisbane, and then obviously played in the Socceroos with him for a number of years. And yeah, I was his roommate at one point as well. And no, he's obviously one of my good football friends. And
is he a good roomie?
Questionable. No, right. No, he's a good guy.
Come on,
he's
stories.
There's no stories.
Stories.
There's no stories. No, he's anyone that knows Cruzy knows that he's always up for a laugh.
So, right.
Not too serious, which is up my alley, I guess. So, no, he's a great guy. And I think that, like I said before, a lot of the criticisms and stuff he's copped has been pretty unwarranted. And I think I'm just really happy for him that now he'll have the chance, which I'm sure he'll take, to prove a lot of people wrong.
You ever gone through a period like that in your career, Tommy, where you're getting a lot of stick from? I'm trying to remember whether you've copped a whole load of abuse. I'm not sure you have, but I know every player goes through this. Robbie seems to have had it more than most. I remember a few years ago, Brett Holman was the whipping boy of the national team. Yep. How do you cope with all that? I mean, do you literally just try and shut it out, or do you have to seek help or support from either your teammates or your coach or, you know, somebody else?
I think that the older you get, the better the more equipped you are to handle it. Yeah. I think when you're young, with social media these days and types of things, and it gives people a platform to sometimes say things which you don't agree with. But yeah, I think that the older you get, the more you understand whose advice is important. And as long as your family and your coaches are pleased with how you're going and all these types of things, then the rest of it's sort of just irrelevant.
What's the worst abuse you ever copped during a game from an opposition supporter, or maybe your own supporters?
I don't know if it's fit to say on air, to be honest.
But Phil will bleep it out. Don't worry if there's swear words in there. Go on.
No, I think it was a few years ago when I first came back to the Brisbane Roar from England, and we had a semi-final against the Wanderers, which we famously lost 4-3. From being 3-0 up, or 5-4 or something,
it was.
And when I was coming off the bench, I remember copying a fair bit of a spray from the people behind me.
The Wanderers fans.
Yeah, I can't remember exactly what was said, but it was pretty vile, to be honest. But I had a good laugh. So.
You just smiled at them, didn't
you?
Yeah,
it was funny.
Unsavoury is probably the right description, but yeah, that's the way it goes. Hey? You've learned to cope with it pretty well.
Just on the Victory Perth game, let's be honest, that was pretty ugly, that game. Yeah. I thought it hit every branch on the ugly tree on the way down. But sometimes that's what you've got to do, isn't it? And Perth are in a bit of trouble.
Well, that's what I was going to say. It's ugly for the Glory right now. I mean, you look at the start of the season, you're going, oh, yeah, they're struggling a bit. Then you see a Wellington win and they're on the bottom and you go, hang on. Now it is panic stations. They've got to get things right straight away. We know about the defensive absentees from last season, but Popper's got to turn around very quickly. Maybe a week in Melbourne will help them galvanise, and some leaders in the dressing room will come out and
play City on Friday, don't they? And that's a ground traditionally where they don't do too badly. So obviously they lost in Melbourne on Friday, but I think it's a chance for them to turn it around. I personally still think they'll be okay.
I think they will be. The week in Melbourne, I think, will be crucial for them. Surely it's time for big players to come and say, all right, let's sort this out, lads. They've got a week together in a hotel, have some heart-to-hearts and get back on track. Popper, I'm sure, will have a big influence in that regard.
Any news on Matt Spiranovic, by the way?
The only thing I saw a couple of days ago was that he's rejected another offer from the Glory. So does it... frustrate's not the right word. Does it bemuse you a little bit that someone with so much talent is just choosing not to play football, Tommy? You went to the World Cup with him in 2014.
Yeah, I mean, his quality speaks for itself, and I think
he's that a great player.
To have him back in the A-League would be great for the league, and obviously as a competitor of the Glory, I wouldn't want him to get back to the Glory, but he's a fantastic player, and I don't know anything about his current situation, so it's not really on me for me to comment, but it would be a shame not to see him back playing in football for sure.
Most certainly. Sydney FC are marching on, go top of the table. They leapfrogged Melbourne City with a victory over Western United. What's happened to them? Three losses in a row. But Adam Lafondra, the story again resonated on the weekend. He's now Sydney FC's third highest goal scorer of all time in a season and a half. And he's the third fastest 25 goals in A-League history behind Fornaroli and Berisha, if you don't mind. So he's in esteemed company. That is, for mine, since Milos Ninkovic, I know Toivonen has been a great signing, but since Milos Ninkovic, I reckon it's the best signing in the A-League.
Natural goal scorer. And when you think that the man that he replaced was Bobo, who what did he score 30-odd goals in all competitions in his last season in Australia. So everybody was looking at Lafondra and saying, oof, you got big boots to fill, Sunshine. But he's done it seamlessly.
And he'll fly past him in terms of goals.
Absolutely superb signing. And again, you know, I'm sure Tommy will concur with this. In the A-League, it's so important you get your foreign signings right. If you get them right, you're half a chance of doing well in this league. And Sydney have done that consistently. I think the only one really... Well, actually, you know what? I'm going to contradict myself a little bit here. Last year, Sim de Jong, Reza Gushanajad, they're a bit in and out, weren't they? Jop van der Linden didn't work. But by and large, they get their imports right.
Massively. And I think you look at Castro and Ninkovic, and they've kind of been the backbone of those two respective sides for the last 5 years or whatever it is. And... it just takes one or two of those players to make the difference in quality, and that wins you games and gets you much more points, and they've for sure got that.
Yeah.
I left out Castro before, but he came before Ninkovic, so I said Ninkovic, I think Lafondra's been just about the best signing.
Absolutely.
In the league.
I wanted to make a point. I don't know whether you had a Twitter question on this, so I might be preempting this, but on this particular game, Western United, we didn't actually go through what caught your eye. We left that out, didn't we?
No, we got a bit bogged down. So I thought we'll just scrap it. I hoped you read the tea leaves on that.
Yeah, there you go. So anyway, what caught my eye this week in a not particularly good way was this incident in the stands where the stewards told the Sydney FC supporters to sit down.
Yeah, nonsense.
In a 36,000 stadium where there's only 4,000 people, you know, rocking around on their own, they're told to sit down, and when one or two didn't, they were thrown out. Come on. You know, I mean, if they're causing trouble, hey, no problem. Chuck them out, lock them up as far as I'm concerned. But, you know, just standing up, singing, chanting, seriously, has this stadium been told what football's about? This is not AFL. This is not any other sport. This has got to be sorted out. And I'll tell you what else I'm disappointed in today. Sydney FC, to be fair to them, have come out and defended their supporters, which I think is great. Whoever is in charge of the A-League at the moment, I think it might be Greg O'Rourke at the moment, but he's not as visible as he used to be. I don't know whether he's under instruction not to be. But somebody really should have been coming out on Monday and saying, this is not on.
Well, on that point, Sydney FC have had to come out.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
And they've attacked the stadium, and rightfully so, and asked questions of the FFA and said, please investigate. But you're right, it shouldn't be on them.
No.
It should be on the league doing it, saying, protect our supporters. They're allowed to, they weren't doing anything wrong. It's ridiculous.
Yeah. Football culture has to be understood.
Yeah.
And
we're getting better, but it's a new stadium.
Yeah, of course it's a new...
They should have been told.
Yeah, but they've hosted enough A-League games down the years to know what football culture is all about. And this sort of nonsense has to be stopped. People are... You know, if you get chucked out of a ground for doing nothing, are you going to be tempted to go back? Let's be perfectly honest.
Yeah.
We can't afford that. So it's time, you know, stand up for your supporters, whoever it is who's in charge.
Well said. Massive win for Newcastle. In a season where so many young players have come through, Angus Thurgate is emerging as a player as well, isn't he? He's been used in different roles by Ernie Merrick, but he's showing a goal-scoring nous as well, which is really encouraging.
Yeah, I think that he's definitely one that's caught the eye so far. As you said, just the amount of goals he's getting alone is impressive for somebody of his age. And I think that's kind of reflective of the league this season. I think there's been a lot of young talent come through that have caught the eye, and it's great to see. And hopefully, as the season goes on, we'll see even more breakthrough into the first team.
Who's the pick of the bunch at your club? I've been impressed with Lewis Miller, who's replacing his namesake, Matthew Miller, at right fullback. Is that his natural position?
Yeah, so he played centre-half a lot for the youth team, but he was... kind of developed more into a right back as he joined the first team. And he played there for the first time in the FFA Cup game against Brisbane Roar that we played. And he had a really good game. And since then, I think he's just come on leaps and bounds. And for a young kid, he's a fantastic athlete. And he's still developing his technical side of the game and the tactical awareness and these types of things. But the foundations, purely from an athletic point of view, are there for him to be a fantastic player.
How good can Samuel Silveira be? You've seen a lot of young players come through over the years. I mean, how much talent does this kid have?
Yeah, he's fantastic. I mean, he's so powerful for someone his age, and I think that's that explosiveness that you can't really you can't teach that, if that makes sense. So obviously, technically, he's really good, and he's quick, and yeah, I think that he's still very raw. He's still got a lot to learn, but for sure he's one that is very exciting for Australian football.
Nice. A massive win for Newcastle. That really was important for the Jets, and a little setback for the Wanderers. Marcus Babbel's not happy. Again, Wellington got their reward and perhaps some deserved luck after a few games this season where they've been in the games and they just haven't quite got the points they deserve from it. So they beat Adelaide 2-1 away. Adelaide have won five in a row, including the FFA Cup final in the lead up to that. So their run ends, but by gee, that penalty, come on. I mean, how does a referee... Okay, the referee calls it, maybe his angle is you know, a little bit skewed. For goodness sakes, we've got VAR for that reason to overrule that. What is... I mean, clearly anyone could see, blind Freddy could see, there was no contact at all to constitute a penalty.
Well, there might have been the slightest of contact.
To constitute a penalty, I
see. But to constitute a penalty, no, I agree with you. But... You know, again, in real time, I don't know if Tommy agrees here, but in real time, I can see why the ref gave it, because they have a millisecond, boom, and it's gone. That's fine. But once you bring VAR into the equation, then the expectation levels are a whole different ball game. And we saw the same the week before, I think it was the week before, the Denis Jeanreau penalty awarded against Western Sydney Wanderers. The week before, Jeanreau was the man involved himself, where the ball's fired into his face from about 2 millimetres away, and he's defending his face and he gets pinged for a handball. Look, what can I say? VAR doesn't work. Is everybody with me? Tommy?
Yeah, I think that the main issue with VAR at the moment is they obviously say that clear and obvious errors are the ones that get fixed, but what's clear and obvious? I think that's
exactly.
So that's, as long as there's humans involved, there's going to be human error, and I think that's the main, that's never going to change.
As a player, does it frustrate you? Do you feel as though every time you score a goal, you think, is it? Do we have to wait for 2 minutes?
Well, I think that takes a little bit away from it. I mean, the raw emotion of when you score a goal, waiting to see if it's allowed or not, and it kind of kills the moment, also for the crowd. And I think that's one thing that's going to need to be fixed. Mm. But otherwise, I can understand the push for it. But for me, I think that things like goal line technology and those types of things, they're of more of a benefit than the VAR.
What I found funny, and let's not take the gloss away from Wellington. Well done. Good win on the road. It really gets things going for them, and they probably deserved it on the balance of play as well.
Definitely.
They've got some good players. Ulysses De Villa has been a really good signing for them. Well done. And good to see David Ball score his first goal. But I did laugh when Nufuktela said, oh, it was 80 metres away from me. I couldn't see. Never mind the fact there was a replay. And Liberato Cacace said, oh, there was contact. I mean, that's contact in the box. That's a penalty. I'm not having a go at them because everyone does that. But it's funny, isn't it, from a player's point of view, Tommy, or someone inside a club, when it's against you, everyone's bleeding blue murder. But when it's your way, there's always some sort of nuance you can apply to it.
Yeah. And I think we've probably been on both ends. We've been lucky on one or two occasions this season not to concede a penalty, and I think against the Wanderers in round one, we were unlucky. So we've kind of seen both sides to it, and I think that every team, you'll win some and you'll lose some in that regard, but for sure it can be sometimes pretty frustrating.
A couple of other things on that game. First of all, I totally agree with you that Wellington, very, very good. That win's been coming, I think. I think that front part of the pitch now, and a lot was made during the off-season of the loss of David Williams, Sarpreet Singh and Roy Krishna, where were the goals going to come from? I think Ufuktele has made some very smart signings. Mm. I love Davila. Mm. I think he's terrific. Proper number 10. David Ball gives you hard running, might not score enough goals at the moment, but you know, it really works hard in that front line. There's Gary Hooper to come in, and a lot of promise with this young Callum McCowan. And Renault Piscopo was very good as well against Adelaide. So I think they've got a lot of potential, Wellington. Conversely, Adelaide were horrible. After the first 20 minutes, I don't know, they just fell into a hole, and they got that brilliant goal
as well
from Mille Usnic. One of the goals of the season, I think, as I said during the call.
Yeah.
But they just weren't at the races. Very strange performance by Adelaide, because you played them a week or two before in Gosford, and the quality of the three goals they scored that day were tremendous.
Yeah, I think as a whole they've been very impressive this start to the season, and I think they've recruited really well, bringing in obviously McGree and Troisi and these kinds of players to complement the pace that they already had, I thought, and the breakthrough of Toure as well, which no one saw coming. But obviously with a few younger players like that, you're probably going to get inconsistency as well, like I touched on before, and maybe that was just one of those weeks.
Let's talk about your career, Tommy. It's a fascinating one. A lot of highs, a couple of drops like everyone goes through in their time. But let's take it all back to when you broke through at Brisbane and you were the new phenom in Australian football and that old lazy tag, the next Harry Kewell, which we've sort of started to get out of the game now, you know, likening players to others. But you had to deal with it and with all of that. How did you find all that talk?
Yeah, I mean, it seems like a long time ago now, which it probably is. But, yeah, no, I think that, like I touched on before, when I was young, 17, 18, breaking through in the A-League and those kind of shouts were getting thrown around, I was pretty fortunate to have such a good family around me and they always kept me very level-headed and all these types of things. And I think it was pretty whirlwind. I remember from the moment I broke through in the A-League to getting my Socceroos debut, I was pretty much overseas before I knew it, playing in Holland. And from being over there, I think that when you're not playing in the A-League and you're not subject to such scrutiny week in, week out, you feel a bit more detached from it. I had probably a bit more respite from these types of things. And I probably found it a bit easier to focus on the football from there on in.
Loved watching you in Holland. I was lucky enough to go visit you, Michael, and Adam Sirota in what was a ridiculous apartment in
Madrid. Why was thinking, it ridiculous?
Oh, it was just, I think the owner gave you his apartment, didn't he?
Yeah, that's right.
They had this like magical pad in like the most beautiful location, three young Aussies playing for the local football team in a university town, mind you. They're all in their early 20s. I remember thinking this must be the most fun any three young Aussie boys could have.
Yeah, we were very fortunate. Yeah, I mean, what to say? I mean, I only have really fond memories of playing there and living there as well. Obviously, the first year probably I was over there, I was so young, so it was quite difficult to be away from my family and I was still such a kid now I think back about it. But I grew up pretty quickly and I was pretty fortunate to move over with two mates, like you said, and that made it a lot easier.
Can I tell you a quick funny story about FC Utrecht? Many years ago, long before you were there, Tommy, I went on a holiday, like a mini break, over to Amsterdam with a mate of mine, you know, to have a few beers and, you know, usual stuff in Amsterdam. And on the Saturday, we were, during the day, a little bit hungover, and we said, you know, what should we do today? Should we go and walk in the canals or the cafes? And my mate said, why don't we watch some football? And I said, yeah, that'd be a great idea. So we got the local paper, which of course was all in Dutch, and looked at the fixtures. And the closest fixture to Amsterdam was FC Utrecht, who were at home to, I think, Heerenveen. So we said, brilliant, let's go to Utrecht. Off we went on the train, got to Utrecht Central, walked to the stadium, and we got the wrong day because we couldn't read the Dutch in the newspaper. We were 24 hours too early, so we had to go all the way back. Anyway, little diversion. Dutch football, did that suit your game? Because very technical league, very skillful competition. Did you feel as though you fitted in that league like a glove?
Yeah, I think it obviously took me a bit of an adjustment period. And the first year I was in Utrecht, we had some big stars playing for the club, so I found it difficult to get into the team, but it was kind of a good transition year for me. And from the second year onwards, I started to play more regularly, and I felt that with time, as time went on, I kind of got used to the style more and more. And as you said, it's very technical, and I think the main differences from the A-League is the A-League's 100 miles an hour and the whole game's pretty end-to-end, and it's sort of you against your opponent, one-on-one matchup the whole game, whereas over there it's much more tactical and you're trying to break down defences, and a lot more of a measured approach, I guess. So, for me, I enjoyed playing that style of football, yeah.
You were flying when I went to visit you in Utrecht. You were doing really well as a young player. Is that the best period of football you've had in your career, playing for them?
Yeah, I think it was probably the least interrupted period in terms of injuries and all those types of things as well. I was pretty fortunate in the 5 years I was there. Didn't really suffer too many injuries and played almost every game for most of the season. So for me, that was fantastic for my development as well at that age, to be playing regular football against good opposition every week. And I have really fond memories of that time.
Season 12-13, you qualified for the Europa League. Was that the best season of your career so far? Because there could still be others.
So I think that it was my third year in Utrecht, and we finished with the highest points tally that Utrecht's ever finished. And it just so happened that year, I think that a few other clubs, like obviously Feyenoord and the usual suspects and PSV and Ajax, did exceptionally well. So we still only got the fourth or fifth finish. But I think that if we had the same season in another year, we would have gotten the top two or three. So it was pretty unlucky in that regard. But for sure, that was a season that, I think I think I got back into the Socceroos fold after a few years from missing out, and it was a really good year.
I remember when you left Utrecht, there were a number of clubs that wanted you. There was so much demand for your signature, justifiably so. I think you were pretty close to going to New York and maybe signing in the MLS, and you went for Ipswich in the Championship, which I think a lot of Australian fans were happy with because it's such a good league with such a high profile. Talk us through that decision and how you reflect on it now.
Yeah, it was a whirlwind time for me, to be honest, coming off contract and the last 6 months of my contract at Utrecht, when I kind of let it known that I wasn't going to stay and re-sign with them, they put me on the outer, and it added a whole new dimension of pressure and those types of things to coming off contract. And it can be pretty stressful at times, as I'm sure a lot of footballers will tell you. But in the end, I was really happy to end up at Ipswich. And it was just a shame that it didn't work out the way that I initially hoped it would. But that's football, and you just move on from these kind of things.
You made your debut, I think, for Ipswich at Old Trafford, didn't you, against Manchester United?
Yeah, it was an FA Cup game. That was a pretty fantastic introduction into English football.
Who was your team as a kid? Did you have an English team as a kid?
Yeah, it was Leeds. Obviously supporting Harry Kewell and Mark Viduka and those types of things. But for me to play at Old Trafford was something I never thought I'd get the chance to do. So to do it on my debut for Ipswich was amazing.
You know what you? I think I've asked this once or twice before on the podcast of various players who played at these hallowed cathedrals of world football. When you're stood there in the tunnel waiting to go out, does your mind go back to playing football on the beach in Southport, and you think, I'm at Old Trafford. I'm about to play against Man United at Old Trafford. Is it that stark, or is your professional mind switched on to, right, it's just another game?
Yeah, I think that it's more the latter. It's probably more after the fact, and maybe a year or two later when you look back and you see it from the bigger picture and what an amazing thing that is. But at the time, you're really focused on the job, and I think that anybody who says otherwise is probably lying to you. So, I think the coaches wouldn't have it any other way.
Mick McCarthy was your manager, wasn't he, at Ipswich? What was he like? How was he to you? What was he like to deal with?
No, he's a great man manager. He was very demanding from his players. And I put simply that the football that season wasn't fitting me, and I wasn't getting much opportunity as well. And I couldn't see it ending well. So I thought that intervening, rather than just waiting it out and knowing that the outcome wasn't going to be good, was a better solution for everyone.
Can I tell you a little quirky story about Mick McCarthy? And again, sort of some parallels with Pim Verbeek in terms of how he was with people. I don't know whether you experienced this. I went to watch Man City. You know I'm a Man City fan. I went to watch the Full Members Cup final in 1986 when I was 19, right? He is a fan. And Mick McCarthy played in that game for Man City. And outside the stadium after the game, we lost 5-4 to Chelsea. I met him, got his autograph, had a very brief chat with him. I was 17 years of age. And then 20 years later, I was a journalist when he was a manager at Millwall. And I walked in to do an interview with him. And he looked at me and said, Wembley, 1986, Full Members Cup final. It was the most bizarre thing. He remembered me, a fan from 20 years ago. And that sort of stuck with me, that he was obviously very aware of people and had that photographic memory. Did you sort of experience anything like that with Mick, that he was very attuned into, players as people?
No, I think that was his biggest strength as a coach, from my experience. And he is a fantastic guy, hands down. And he's the kind of coach that you really wanted to play for and you really wanted to succeed and help him do well. And that's often not the case in a lot of these clubs overseas. And I think that was kind of refreshing for me to have a coach like that.
What went wrong, Tommy?
I think it was more the tactical and probably the style of football in the Championship. Mm. It was I was probably more of a victim of that as opposed to anything that he did or anything like that. And but thinking back about Mick McCarthy, I only have good things to say about him.
What's football life like in Cyprus?
Mixed. It's to be honest, I like similar words to say about Cyprus as England. I'm only good things to say about it.
Beautiful country.
Yeah, it was a fantastic place to live. Obviously, living on the Mediterranean, great food, weather, beaches, all these types of things, and the football there as well. They're very passionate about their football. Which was sometimes, I think that's probably the one thing that sticks with me is the fanaticalness, I guess, if that's a word, of the supporters on match day there was something I had not experienced before. So that's one vivid memory I have of Cyprus.
You've had a wonderful time with the Socceroos. You've been part of such big moments. You went to a World Cup in 2014, played in enormous qualifiers. Do you still harbour ambitions to get back? Is that still like a tangible motivation? Is that one of your key drivers still?
To be honest, it's not something I think about, but you'd never rule out anything. But for me, I'm just trying to enjoy my football and do as well as I can. And I'm enjoying being injury-free at the moment and trying to help the team as much as I can week in, week out. And obviously being a bit more of a leader in a younger team now as well, that a new responsibility for me. And we'll just see where that takes me. And I'm not really looking too far ahead, to be honest.
One of the biggest moments of your career, and I was fortunate enough to call it, was your first international goal, the World Cup qualifier away to Japan, which was played in front of a 60-odd thousand in Saitama. I remember it being a brilliant atmosphere. They were going for qualification. They only needed a point, I think. And your goal gave Australia the lead. I think it was meant as a cross.
Yeah, it was definitely a
and
cross.
It sort of looped up over Eiji Kawashima and went into the top corner. Must have been a great moment.
Yeah, I mean, I think if I remember correctly, I went on a bit of a dribble and I think I lost my balance as I went to cross the ball, and luckily for me, it went in the goal. But obviously, yeah, I was happy to score my first goal for my country and didn't really care how it came, to be honest. And obviously such an important goal in the context of the qualifying as well, which was pleasing for me. And yeah, it was great. And it was a shame that we conceded the equaliser a few minutes
later.
Your
old mate Matty Mackay, eh?
Yeah, I mean, we probably wouldn't have been in that position if he wasn't playing. So he was fantastic for the Socceroos during that period. But I guess that's... all a long time ago now, and yeah, it's just good memories.
We've got some Twitter questions. I wanted to ask this anyway, but Nick Collins has asked, the one big moment that stands out, the Dutch 2014, you've got that chance with Matthew Leckie to, would have put Australia 3-1 up, I think.
Yeah, I think so.
Do you still think about that, and how it, does it ever play through your mind, or do you just move on, that's football? And
off, not really, you know? To be honest. For sure. For a while after that, I was obviously, dwelling on it. Not dwelling is the wrong word, but regretting the way it panned out. But as a footballer, I think if you let those kind of moments get the better of you, I mean, every game there's chances that you miss or things that you do well, sure. And you just kind of have to move on. Even on the weekend just gone, I missed one at the back post where I didn't expect it when Jamie Young made a save, and that was probably worse, but no one's talking about it. So, I think these kind of things as a footballer, you're just trying to take it week in, week out and take the highs with the lows and don't let it kind of affect you.
You played in one of Australia's greatest ever World Cup performances. Even though we lost against the Dutch, it was an awesome, awesome encounter that everyone remembers. So,
did you have a good view of Timmy's volley?
Yeah, great.
If you didn't, Timmy will tell you all about it.
I see a post on Twitter every 2 weeks from Ryan McGowan when he came out his sits, so it's definitely in my memory.
That gets under Timmy's skin that Ryan McGowan always talks about his success, and he's like, it was my goal, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Brilliant.
Good
Brilliant.
Stuff. Mate, great to talk about your career, and you've got so much more to offer, which we'll watch with interest.
I wanted to ask, sorry, Garby, I mean, we seem to think that you've been around for so long that you're almost a veteran these days. You're 27. I mean, you're still really at the peak of your career. You've got another potentially 7 or 8 years left. What are your ambitions? Garby asked you about the Socceroos, but in terms of the next 2 or 3 years, are your ambitions to get back overseas or stay here, you know, win things with the Mariners, or what's in your head over the next 2 or 3 years?
Honestly, not sure. I've got a pretty open mind about it. I think that given the last few years that I've had, for me, this season was all about playing regular football and just enjoying it again. After being so unlucky with injuries and stuff, it can sometimes just get the better of you and take a bit of a mental and emotional toll. And for me, I just wanted to enjoy my football and see what happened. And I think that I'm looking to try and improve my performances as the season goes on and see what happens. And I'm still very ambitious, and I still think that I have a lot of good years ahead of me. And but I think that that will only come to fruition if you kind of take care of the now and perform well week in, week out now. And that's all I'm trying to put all my energy towards. And in the coming months, we'll kind of see what the situation is and what unfolds and make a decision from there, I guess.
Did you fall out of love with football a little bit after your experiences at Ipswich and then your injury problems?
No, I've always loved football, but sometimes it can be a bit numbing, I guess. Obviously you put all your effort and your whole life's kind of tailored to be playing football, and when things aren't going well, it can sometimes be pretty devastating. But like I said earlier, I'm pretty fortunate to have such a good family and people around me to really put things in perspective.
And you're studying as well. You're making plans for post-football. Yeah. Business finance you're studying.
Yeah, I'm not sure if it's interesting or not enough for me yet, but I thought that after chatting with the PFA to do something on the side also for my headspace with football would be of benefit, and I'm really enjoying studying, and it kind of, puts your mind onto something else as well, which I think is healthy.
Good stuff, mate. Lionel Messi won his sixth Ballon d'Or this morning.
You voted for him, Garvey.
I did. I was the Australian judge again, which I'm very fortunate to be in, to be asked to do it, which is great. It's a lot of pressure because they make the votes public. So you get scrutinised. And I've already had one person tweet me on Twitter this morning, "You are a disgraceful cheat of a journalist." for putting that cheat Lionel Messi ahead of Virgil van Dijk. Thank you to that gentleman. It's the constructive feedback that we like in this world.
Can I just tell you, I vote in the World Soccer Magazine's awards. They don't make our votes public, thank goodness. And I did actually vote for Virgil van Dijk.
Yeah, well, there you go.
Even as a City fan, I voted for Virgil van Dijk.
The night I set myself to do it, I sat there for hours because it's a long process. You look at all the stats and you watch over the course of the year and it's tough. But in the end, I went for Messi just because, as much as I love Virgil, and I'm a Liverpool fan, I know how good he is. I went for Messi, and I'm happy he won it because I just think what he does is the most difficult thing to do in the game. As good as a defender as Virgil is, and there have been so many great defenders, and he's probably, since Cannavaro, I don't think anyone's had as much of an impact in a calendar year than Van Dijk's had. But doing what Messi does is the most difficult thing to do in the game. And just because he's been doing it for so long, I don't think we should accept that it's the norm, because it's not the norm. It's not the norm to play like that.
He's the victim of his own success.
Of course he is. Yeah. Yeah. People go, it's Messi. He does this every year. That's what makes him arguably the greatest footballer ever.
Yeah.
He scored 45 goals, but it's the way in which he scores them, taking the ball and just running the show on his own. He led Barcelona to a title. For me, he just edged Van Dijk. It was close, but I just had him ahead. So lucky I got that one right.
And he scored overnight as well.
Yeah. I think with Messi as well, obviously the statistics are incredible, but it's more than that. I mean,
exactly.
So the way that he is instrumental in their build-up and takes the ball off the defenders, and sometimes he won't get the assist or goal, but he was instrumental in getting there. And I think it's just, for me, every year he plays, he's the best player in the world, regardless of the trophies or the statistics, and that's just my opinion.
Exactly right. Yeah. I had Messi 1, Van Dijk 2, Ronaldo 3, got the top three in order. Then I had Sadio Mane 5, which is where he finished. I had your boy Raheem Sterling in 4th, who was the outlier looking at the voting. Yeah. But I put him 4th, just, they won a treble of trophies. He scored a lot of goals. He's probably become England's best player over the last 12 months.
No doubt. I thought
he was harshly treated by some of the other judges. I thought he deserved to finish much higher. I had him in 4th.
I can only concur with that.
He was a Football Writers Player of the Year as well.
Yeah, Riyad Mahrez got a fair bit of attention as well. I'm not sure that was that was quite right.
But the judges come from all over the world, so it's different views.
And some, probably have, with respect, their own agendas or their own focus because of the part of the world that they're in. Yeah. We're probably the same in many respects, particularly with regards to Sam Kerr when it comes to the Women's Awards. We tend to look at her perhaps and ignore some of the female players that play in Europe. So, they're always subject to these awards, aren't they? But they're nice discussion points.
Arsenal, let's just touch on them quickly because they sacked Unai Emery late last week. They run the risk now, if they don't get this next managerial choice right, of falling the way of Manchester United post Sir Alex. I think they were in a different scope compared to United when Sir Alex left, because Sir Alex left on a high, Wenger left when things had dropped down a little bit. But, gee, they've got to get this next appointment spot on or else they're going to go that way. Emery just didn't work out at all, mainly in a defensive sense. He didn't sort that out, and he had enough time.
Maybe they can go for Bielsa.
Yeah.
Your boy.
Leeds.
Leeds.
You're right. No, I think that it's getting more and more ruthless to be a manager these days, and especially in the Premier League, and it's not a job that...
You don't fancy it when you're finished?
Yeah, I'm not envious of the managers, to be honest. I mean, you look what happened to Pochettino this season, and it's very short memories. So
I think Nuno Espirito Santo would be an excellent choice. Sorry, Wolves fans. But his name has been mentioned in dispatches, along with Mikel Arteta and one or two others. I wonder if they might look at maybe even an Ancelotti. But he's having a rough trot as well at Napoli.
I think Allegri's the favourite, and Brendan Rodgers is being discussed as well. Leicester.
Rodgers has come out and said he doesn't want it,
but that doesn't necessarily mean anything. Yeah. But I don't think he will go. I mean, Leicester, what a story! Flying in second, 8 points behind the Reds. Jonjo Shelvey delivered for Liverpool on the weekend. Probably his biggest contribution as a Liverpool player.
Yeah,
to make it 11 points to City.
Like, I can't see that Liverpool are going to lose four games.
To City,
to allow that gap to be closed with us. Our defence is way too porous at the moment. The loss of Laporte has been monstrously big. The decision not to replace Vincent Kompany. I mean, we've been through all this before. City look a little bit leaky this season. That's not to say that they're not a great side. And Kevin De Bruyne has scored an absolute worldie against Newcastle. But the fact that they couldn't hold on to that lead is, you know, Liverpool. When you look at Liverpool, the games that Liverpool have played this season where they haven't played well, they've managed to grind out a result. They've got a last-minute goal or, you know, hung on. And they weren't fantastic against Brighton. They lost their goalkeeper, Alisson, for a red card. Still managed to get the job done. That's the difference. I think Liverpool win it this year.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah.
I agree.
God, it hurts to say that. And you know we're never going to hear the last of this, Tom.
Well, hopefully not.
Oh, my God.
For 30 years, they've given us crap about not winning the league, so we'll spend 30 years telling them we won it.
Only 30.
Hopefully. Make it 35 if you want to. Let's get through to some Twitter questions. This is a good one from the Australian Football Podcast. Have a listen to them if you want to. They ask, who is leading the race for the Johnny Warren medal early on? Ooh. Any ideas, Tommy, from the guys you've played against?
I'd go for Jamie McLaren.
I would as well.
Yeah, I think his goal scoring record is. Yeah. I've never seen a goal scoring record in the A League like this, like at the start of this season. So if he can maintain anything even close to what he's doing now, then I think that he's a shoo-in.
Ryan McGree, not far behind.
McGree, I was going to say. And Ola Toivonen has been involved in every victory goal. I mean, he might struggle for votes because they haven't done so well so far this season, but I think you'll see he'll be there when it's. When it's business time.
Lafondra?
Lafondra as well. But I think McLaren has to be a runaway leader at this stage. One from Bradley Owens. Why has the Wanderers' form dropped off in recent weeks? We didn't touch on them before.
Well, good question. And to be honest, you know, the heat has to start being applied to Marcus Babbel. Everybody likes Marcus. He's a great personality. Super guy to interact with, but it's not working at the moment. And, you know, the mantra was pre-season, no excuses. And there aren't any this year. This is his squad. They've got the training ground. They've got the new stadium. They started well, even though they weren't playing necessarily very well, apart from the game against Melbourne Victory, where I thought they were good. But it's stodgy at the moment. And, you know, that loss to Newcastle, that really puts the pressure on. I think they've got trips to come to Wellington and Perth over the next couple of weeks. You know, long road trips, tough matches to play. I think there's a big conversation that it may be about to be had about Marcus Babbel's future unless they start picking up wins once again.
It's been a big weekend for this Twitter account, Lee Broxham Facts, which is kind of like kind of like the Chuck Norris type situation, you know, as if Lee Broxham could do everything better than how it's meant to be done. But so he wants to know, Tommy, if a youth player was about to sign for a club in Cyprus, what sort of heads up would you give them about culture, people, football, those sorts of things?
I think it can be a lot more hostile in Cyprus than if you compare it to with Western Europe. For me, if I was advising a young player who had ambitions to go to Europe to further his career, it would, with all due respect to Cyprus, probably not be high on my list. And that's nothing against the quality of the football there or the coaching that I received when I was there, but it's more their mentality. If you don't produce straight away, they're pretty ruthless in offloading players and getting new ones in and these types of things. And it can be a pretty ruthless environment, I guess, to be a footballer. So unless you're maybe a bit older and a bit more well-equipped to handle that kind of situation, it wouldn't be, something I'd recommend, probably.
You've got the bye this week. It's a new addition to the A-League. What do you do in the week of a bye? I know you're a big muso. You're going to go check out a couple of gigs and all things like that?
Nah, we're busy on the training ground this week, obviously on the back of a loss. Like I said, Stadger has us working very hard and I'm just enjoying being fit again. But for me, it's all football this week and looking forward to our next home game next week against Sydney FC. And we've got a lot of hard work to do before that game.
You do play a bit of guitar as well. What sort of tunes do you...
I don't play very well, but but I enjoy playing, and I'm very into music, I like rock music, I guess. So
good. Give us a couple of bands. Come on.
I like Led Zeppelin and
yes,
type of things.
Yes, Tommy.
Well, he gave me a band that I loved before when we were off air.
Yeah, the Lumineers.
Lumineers.
I have a bit of a range of music taste, but for sure, it's all pretty similar themed, and it's all quite rocky and
good stuff.
You and Jackson Irvine in Socceroos camp when you were with him, just talk for hours about music because he's a crazy muser.
He is, yeah. Now, funnily, we've never really overlapped too much. We've been only a couple of camps where we've both been in, but I know Jackson from a long time ago, and we often talk about music.
Who's got the weirdest musical taste at the Mariners?
To be honest, I don't know. Probably me. I think that'd probably be the answer.
Well, it's obviously, I dare say the musical taste is a lot more eclectic than when Paul Okon was there and he just played horses after a bit. You probably get something a bit more different now when Tommy Orr's got the iPod in hand.
Yeah, no, I don't get that that responsibility. I think no one would be very pleased with my choices. So,
We're pleased with your choice to come into the podcast studios today, Tommy. It's been great, really good to talk football with you, to get your insight into so many different things and the A-League in particular and your career. You're going well. Great to see you back out there fit and firing. So thanks to you for coming in. Thanks to the Mariners.
Tommy.
Dave Jordan from Central Coast, their media manager, has been listening in for the full show. And thanks to Dave for bringing Tommy in and for the club. For helping us out. So we hope you enjoyed it. Football fans in Australia, Simon, thanks to you.
Good to see you, Garby.
You too, mate. Thanks to Phil Pryor for putting it all together, as he always does. That's the Fox Football Podcast on a Tuesday this week. Adam will be back later in the week, no doubt. We'll be back next Monday with the normal podcast as it usually stands. Enjoy your week.